Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage's completely online process lets you get a custom mortgage solution wherever and whenever you want. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Ina Garten is a genuine star of our food-obsessed age, known for her Food Network show The Barefoot Contessa. She says she thinks of herself as a cookbook author and home chef who wandered into television by mistake. Her style is easy, elegant, and on the food front, delicious. Her number one taster, her longtime husband, Jeffrey. She talks about him all the time. This hour on Point, we're talking with Ina Garten about cooking for Jeffrey. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What's your question for the Barefoot Contessa, for Ina Garten? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Ina Garten, New York Times bestselling cookbook author, Emmy-winning TV host and culinary cultural icon. She's host of the Food Network's Barefoot Contessa, author of 10 wildly popular cookbooks. Her newest, Cooking with Jeffrey, is out now. Ina Garten, welcome to On Point.
So nice to talk to you. How are you?
I'm great.
I've been listening to your voice for years. So nice to finally meet you.
Yeah, it's great to have you right here. What's your style, Ina, when it comes to cooking?
You know, I think one of the things I'm always looking for in a recipe is that it's a remembered flavor, but it's more delicious and easier to prepare than you expect.
A remembered flavor. What does that mean?
Well, I remember in my first book I had pan-fried onion dip, which is, remember that old Lipton's onion soup mix?
Of course. There was a time
with
when
sour
that,
cream.
Right.
And I thought, why can't this be better? So I sautéed onions, very slowly cooked onions in butter for a long time and brought out the sweetness of it and made pan-fried onion dip. So it's a remembered flavor, but it tastes better than you thought. And what I love about that recipe is so many people say they made it for a dinner party. They ate the entire thing before the party. And then they had to make it again.
Is that the source of what we most love? Does it all tie back to remembered flavors? I mean, you've got all these exotic chefs out there doing fusion this and that and kind of things that look like science experiments and can be taste amazing. But is it all about that, you know, the Proust's Madeleine, what we tasted and loved when we were 5 years old? Old?
For me, it is. But I think I divide restaurant cooking from home cooking. And I think when you go out, you want to be entertained, you want to be challenged. But home cooking, nobody really wants octopus with lemongrass. I think what everybody really wants is a really good roast chicken and, you know, great pasta and, you know, sort of things that they remember, but they're absolutely delicious. And because it's home cooking, we're not professional chefs. It has to be really easy to prepare.
So here you are at 10 cookbooks, and I always shake my head.
Isn't that crazy?
Yes, it is. Well, I mean, good for you, and clearly a lot of people have enjoyed them. But how on earth, if you've been, and you obviously have been, sort of pouring yourself into these one after another, by the 10th one, what do you have left to say? Haven't you covered all the basics of a good roast chicken and right on down?
You know, it's interesting. I think after my first book, and it was about my store, the Barefoot Contessa, so I told the story of that, and there were all the recipes from the store, and it was such a surprise success, and the publisher called and said, we need another book immediately. And I was like, I've written all my recipes. I'm done. And they were like, no, you don't understand. We need another book. And so I thought, well, I had done catering for years, so I collected all of the catering recipes that I did and called that Barefoot Contessa Parties. And when I was done with that, I thought, okay, that's it. But there's something about, it's kind of like exercise. The more you use that muscle, the better you are at it. And now I literally, after 10 books, I can sit down and write a list of 100 ideas of things that I want to work on. Some will work out, some will drop off the list. I'll add things as I go along. But I've always got things that I'm working on.
But does that mean they're new recipes, Ina, or you old? Have you figured out how to make roast chicken even better than you did 20 years ago? I don't know.
Well, I'll tell you one that I've been working on for like 2 books is Boston cream pie. I mean, we all remember that it's not pie at all. It's like a sponge cake
with cream
pastry cream in the middle and chocolate glaze on it. And it's usually so boring. And so I've been playing around with it, with orange zest and Grand Marnier in the pastry cream and chocolate with a little coffee in it. And getting the textures and the flavors exactly right just hasn't gelled for me yet. But I'm still working on it.
Oh. So do you, have you got it? Are you still?
Not yet.
For the 11th cookbook?
Maybe the next book, yeah.
Unbelievable.
But I love that challenge.
And there it is. And this time you got Jeffrey right in the middle of it. Now, he's been around in your life for a long, long time. Is it 50 yeah. years you've been? Is it?
We've been married for 48. I've known him for 53. Yeah. Since I was 15.
Anybody who watches your show knows you talk about him all the time. He's your
He's my mentor, the love of my life, and my best friend.
This is kind of different. Not everybody, you know, brings their hubby into the middle of their cooking work. Why is he in the middle of yours?
Well, you know, I think people think this is about my cooking for Jeffrey, literally. But really what it's about is that cooking for Jeffrey is really what created my career. When we first got married, I didn't know how to cook at all. And I started cooking, and I loved doing it. And he loved when I made dinner for him or made something, you know, a wonderful party for friends. Mm-hmm. And he just always encouraged me. And then at some point, when I was working in Washington, actually in the White House in nuclear energy policy, if that's a crazy thing. Exactly. And at some point, he said, you know, you love cooking. Why don't you just develop that and do something in the food business? So cooking for Jeffrey is really what created my career, which is really what the book is about.
You were 30 before you really went down this road. Is that right?
I just turned 30 when I left nuclear energy policy and bought a specialty food store in a place I'd never been, which was the Hamptons.
That's got all kinds of interesting pieces embedded in it. But one is just lots of people who may have just turned 30 and they're on a path and they might think, ooh, this is fantastic. Or they might think, gosh, I got myself on this career path, but I don't know if this is where my passion is. I mean, what made it possible or what gave you the nerve to say, forget about it. I don't need to work for the Reagan administration. I don't need to think about nuclear policy. I'll go buy a little.
It wasn't the Reagan administration.
Oh, excuse me.
But still. But it's okay. It was the Carter administration.
Carter. Even earlier. All right.
It was even earlier. Exactly.
Okay.
I have a very low threshold of boredom. I really like to do things that stimulate me, and I felt I had done what I could do there. And I think we all want to find something that when we get up in the morning, that's what we feel like doing, whether it's our job or not. And that's what I love to do is cook. So following that really was important to me. And what you have to remember is my grandparents were immigrants, and when my grandfather first came here, he had a candy store. Mm. And then the next generation, my father was a surgeon. And so there was a huge regression. When I told them I was buying a food store, they were like, whoa, 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 wait a minute.
Right. That's
this
what we came to America
wrong direction.
For, right?
Exactly.
Next thing you know, you're heading back to the shtetl.
Exactly. And my father said, what are you going to do, live over the store?
Yeah.
So it was a real leap of faith, but I just felt I needed to try something else.
Why the Hamptons? I mean, now it's out there. It's a symbol of uber wealth and all the rest. But the shop you bought, I'm looking at a photograph here from the new cookbook, Cooking for Jeffrey. And
isn't that
this
crazy?
It's just a small, little, modest specialty food shop, as you can imagine, with screen door and the folks are standing behind it. And the door is at least, a tenth of the
tiny.
Front of the store. Yeah.
It was tiny. And it was about 400 square feet. It was a total fluke. I just think of myself as one of the luckiest people I know. It was a fluke that it was in the Hamptons. I saw that ad sitting at my desk at Office of Management and Budget, and I thought, oh, that sounds really interesting. And I actually put the ad in the book, because you look at this little ad and you think, what about that would have gotten me to leave my job in the White House and move to West Hampton? And yet I just found some romance in it.
You got attention before you knew it. I mean, you started out as a caterer there, sort of catering for the wealthy. And, by the time your first cookbook came out, no less than Martha Stewart was paying attention. I have a little tape here. This is the Barefoot Contessa, 1999, first cookbook was out. And the gourmet food and lifestyle uber guru, especially at that time, Martha Stewart, featured you and your shop on her TV program. This is Martha Stewart Living, 1999.
The Barefoot Contessa is a 3,000-square-foot emporium of Epicurean excellence, delighting both the eye and the palate. But this feast for the senses was created not by a gourmand, but by a desk-bound bureaucrat who wanted a change.
I'm not sure that sounds like a big compliment exactly, but Martha deigned to pay attention to you.
She was wonderful to me, just wonderful. And I really had no—I mean, she was— I think, inspired everybody of my generation about lifestyle books and TV, and she's just extraordinary.
Okay, we hear the respect then, but you're two different people, two different ways. What's the difference between you and Martha Stewart when it comes to food and entertaining and the Ina Garten way versus the Martha Stewart way?
I think Martha likes things that are a little fancier than I do, and yet not. I don't know. It's pretty hard to put my finger on what the difference is, because I think she's really inspired the flavors and the fresh food and cooking at home. And I think Martha's also about what I'm about, which is when you cook, everybody shows up, and that's when people connect with each other. So I don't think there's that much difference. I think, you know, in the 90s, people were carving out pumpkins to put the pumpkin soup in, mm-hmm. because Martha taught them how to do it. And then by the time we got to 2000, it was like, okay, enough of the pumpkins. Let's just have the soup.
We're going to have some of your food here today. My producers have been good enough to make it. And I've got your challah bread with saffron right on the table. Old recipe of yours, I think. Really
yeah.
delicious.
Thank you. Am I
seeing the color of saffron, that beautiful orange in this bread? Does it change it just a little? I think I do.
And there's just a little bit of spice. You can see a little of the
little
filaments of saffron in
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
And it just, it's a kind of, you don't want it to overpower the bread because bread is a very fairly mm-hmm. mild flavor.
Mm-hmm.
But it really balances the butter and the challah and the spiciness of the saffron. It's a very kind of old-fashioned challah recipe.
Is it on your table when Jeffrey makes it home for Friday
oh,
night?
Oh, always. I always make it. No.
Well,
for special occasions.
It's beautiful. And a twist on
you.
Something. Talk about what a remembered flavor for many people. That's a very special one, of course.
So challah is a very traditional thing, but the little hit of saffron just gives it a little more flavor and a little more interest, and yet it's still a remembered flavor.
Maybe that's the Ina Garten recipe, the basic recipe right there.
Don't tell anybody.
Okay, big secret. Ina Garten is with us. Her 10th, count them, 10, her 10th cookbook, Cooking for Jeffrey, a Barefoot Contessa cookbook, is just out. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour with cooking queen, the Barefoot Contessa, Ina Garten, about good cooking, about how she found herself at the center of America's food fascination, about her new cookbook, Cooking for Jeffrey, and that love story. You can join us this hour. Is she your inspiration? Do you know Ina Garten's story, how she followed her dream? Do you know Jeffrey from Ina's show? What do you think of a cookbook built around cooking for the hubby? And what's your question for Ina Garten? Much of her Food Network show, the Barefoot Contessa, focuses on preparing meals for her husband, Jeffrey, their friends in East Hampton, New York. Often, Ina prepares special meals for Jeffrey to celebrate his return from a business trip. Here she does, in an episode from way back in the show's fourth season, just that.
Oh, Jeffrey's here.
Hi, sweetie.
How was your trip?
It was a long trip.
I've got a treat for you.
You do? What?
Yeah. I always have to have something special when you come home, right?
What you got for me?
Beside me, you mean?
Yeah, what do you got?
I'd say you need a little hot chocolate, wouldn't you say?
Ooh,
so?
Ooh, that looks good.
How's that?
That looks delicious.
Like you get in France.
Jeffrey's home. Jeffrey's home. Tell us about Jeffrey. Who is he, this longtime love of yours?
Well, Jeffrey's actually had a very complex career. He started out when we were in the government. He was in the State Department with Kissinger, and then came when I bought the story, came to New York with me and was an investment banker for years, and then went back to Washington to be Undersecretary of Commerce in the Clinton administration. And then after that, went to Yale. He was the dean of the business school at Yale, and now teaches at Yale, and he's on lots of boards.
So, I mean, we get the sense
that
he was always somewhere else.
In his spare time, he writes books.
Okay, and that too. But he was always somewhere else and coming home to you. And that food that met him was a big part of your relationship.
Well, one of the things about East Hampton is my business has always been there, but there's really nothing for him to do there. So he generally leaves on Monday and comes back on Thursday or Friday. And I want to be sure he always comes back. So if there's a roast chicken in the oven, it's more likely that he'll show up.
We got a question on Twitter for you. Is being a great cook the secret to a successful marriage?
Well, I think it doesn't hurt. I think cooking is hard. I mean, I'm not a trained professional chef. I'm a home cook. I've just had a lot of experience doing it. And I think that cooking for people really takes care of them. So I think it's a very nurturing thing that makes people feel good. And so I think it's all part of a big package. It's not just getting dinner on the table. It's about taking care of people and nourishing them and making them feel that they're worth the effort to do that.
My marvelous producer, Tanya, has made for me your skillet roasted lemon chicken. It's on the table right now. I've already been nibbling during the break. It smells delicious. Describe this for us, if you would, Ina Garten.
So I think it's the recipe in the book that I've made for Jeffrey more than anything else in this book. Mm. It's a cast iron skillet. You can just buy it at the hardware store. You put in sliced lemons, sliced onions, sliced garlic, and then you have the butcher butterfly a chicken for you, and you make an herb oil, which you brush on the whole chicken. You throw it in the oven 45 minutes at a high temperature, and it comes out with the juices and the lemon and the onions and garlic all cooked together, and it makes the sauce, and it's so delicious.
It's just got that nice little kick. Oh, I'm having a great time here. It's got that little kick in it. It's not. This is all the soothing quality of roast chicken, but with that edge on it from the lemon, which is just delicious. That little kick.
And isn't it interesting that you eat the whole lemon after it's cooked for 45 minutes?
I'm right there. We've got lots of callers for you. Buffalo, New York. Aaron is calling. Aaron, you are on the air with Ina Garten.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Ina.
Aaron.
I just called to say that I absolutely love what you do. I love how comfortable and approachable you make cooking.
And thank you.
I didn't grow up in a home that we always cook meals and things like that together. So how you go about it made it really easy for me to start getting really passionate and really interested in cooking. And also, you and Jeffrey are my favorite power couple.
Thank you. I don't know about power, but I'm glad we're your favorite couple.
What made it easy, Aaron? What made it easy for you to dive in down the Ina path?
It is complex enough that you really feel at the end you have something that is you're excited to give people and excited to share with people and like build around. And it's nice enough for company, as she always says. But it's broken down and explained to you in a way that you can use these techniques to build your own recipes and kind of build your own path of knowledge.
Wow.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
I love that. Thank you, Aaron. That's wonderful.
Right. Not just to find the way. Aaron, what's your favorite out of her, out of Ina's 10, count them, cookbooks?
Oh, that's so hard. I always make your coconut cake for my grandmother on her birthday, and she's 90, and I've been doing that for about the last 10 years.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And she loves it. So I do it every year for her.
Well, wish her happy birthday for me.
Coconut cake for the grandmother. Aaron, thank you so much. I'm going crazy here just with the description. Where did you folks come up with your name? My great aunt was named Ina. I loved her. She was fantastic.
Seriously?
But I haven't known an Ina since I sat at her knee 10,000 years ago.
And here was your grandmother from?
This is my great aunt. She was from Central Illinois. And Ina, all the way. Ina Orndorff.
Isn't that interesting? I think it's some people say Eastern European. It's Scandinavian. My grandparents are from Eastern Europe, and I think that's probably where I came from. And I was named after my grandfather, whose name started with an I.
Right, so passed down
so
the I.
So not too many options.
And we get to Ina. I love hearing it again. I haven't even heard it in years apart from
nice.
You. And I'm glad.
See, that's a remembered sound for you.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Oh, it's a very precious thought to me. Kate in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Kate, you're on the air. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Ina. Thanks for taking my call. I am really inspired by your origin story, starting your shop in East Hampton. And I actually have a cousin, Rick Easton, who's a baker. And I am trying to get him to strike out on Long Island and leave New York, the city where... seems like there's a glut of people trying to make their dreams come true. And I just wonder, what is your advice for a young entrepreneur in the food industry? Where to start their shop? Where to plant their roots?
Ooh, that's a good practical question.
Well, I think first thing you want to do is look around the area and make sure that people in the area you're interested in really like to care about food. You want to, I mean, I always think like ethnic communities are fantastic because they really value food. They value putting dinner on the table. And so, and bakeries are really important for that. But also, I think we always stand on the side of the pond and we're always trying to figure out whether the water's hot or cold. You have to like jump in the pond and splash around and see where it takes you. It's not about making a decision that you're going to have to live with for the rest of your life. It's about starting the process. And I think as long as you keep yourself open to where that process is going to lead you, I think you do much better.
Now, I wish we had Jeffrey here too, in a way. I mean, was there at the business school at Yale. I mean, you didn't choose, this wasn't random. Maybe it was, but I mean, the Hamptons, that you've got a lot of cash there. You've got a lot of people rolling through there. The good life is especially sort of famously exalted there. There's cash flow. All these things must come in if you're thinking about a location, shouldn't they?
That's what I'm saying. I think you need to be sure because prepared food is expensive to buy. You want to be sure there are enough people around that can afford to buy it. But, I mean, it's not – a bakery is not crazy. You can go out and buy a cake for $20 that's a special occasion.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't have to be every day. So I think you just want to make sure that – and I have to say, Tom, I went to West Hampton.
Mm-hmm.
Originally, I don't have any idea whether I understood what it was. I saw this ad for a specialty food store. Jeffrey and I drove up. We looked at it. I thought they were baking chocolate chip cookies.
Yeah.
I thought, this is where I need to be. So I think I vaguely knew the Hamptons, but I had never been there before, and I'm not sure it was as deliberate a decision as it sounds.
Was it then what it is now? I mean, now it's become sort of synonymous with uber wealth in this country.
It's everything. There are farmers. It's a very broad cross-section. It's expensive to live there, so it requires a certain level of wealth, but it's not as rich as you think it is.
Mm.
I mean, there are houses on the beach that are very expensive, but there are also – I live in the village of East Hampton. It's not the same thing at all.
Yeah, no, driving through, it's true, is different from flying in a helicopter, I suppose, over the beach where the super mansions are. But, boy,
yeah,
they sure do catch your eye. Diana in Miami, Florida. Diana, you're on the air with Ina Garten in New York. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Ina. It's great talking to you.
Hi, Diana. Great to talk to you, too.
My grandmother was a Cuban chef. She had the first Cuban-Spanish restaurant in New Orleans in the 70s.
Wow.
And, she was a huge fan of yours, and she passed away last year.
Oh.
And she would watch your show religiously. Even though she didn't speak much English, she understood the recipes and the cooking. So she loved it.
Well, cooking doesn't necessarily have a language. You know what it is by looking at it. What a wonderful story, Diana.
Exactly. Thank you. So my question is, since my grandmother is a huge influence for me, and now that she passed on, I'm actually trying out her recipes. Did you have someone like that growing up in your family, someone who maybe had a traditional recipe that you're incorporating into what you do today?
My mother was a kind of a serviceable cook. She didn't love cooking. She just did it to get dinner on the table. I think the person that I take after was my grandmother, who just cooked for everybody. I always remember her in the kitchen. But I was quite young when she passed away, so I don't have any recipes. But I think it's her love of cooking that really kind of inspired me. My grandfather's business was next door, and all the employees used to come and just raid the refrigerator. I think she always was always feeding everybody in the neighborhood, which is really lovely.
So when you started, and Diana, thanks so much for your call from
thanks, Diana.
Miami. And it's wonderful to think of your Cuban grandmother in New Orleans starting out with Cuban food there and making and watching Ina at the same time. So when you started, how did you find your – and you moved from the specialty food shop. You got into catering. You got to kind of have a style. You got to have some panache there. What were you modeling it on then if you didn't have one great beacon? I mean, your grandma pumped it out, but sounds like you went off in your own direction.
Do you know, I'm a big fan of Malcolm Gladwell's books, and one of his is called The Outliers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really about following what you love to do and doing it. And just doing it over and over and over again. So the whole 10 years that I lived in Washington, or the whole 10 years before I bought the store, when Jeffrey and I were married and then we lived in Washington, I cooked all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I really learned by working my way through Julia Child's Mastering the Art of French Cooking and Craig Claiborne's New York Times cookbook. I really learned the basics of cooking for myself. And I think that's the basis of what I did after that. So I was very fortunate. I didn't think I understood it at the time, but especially food store is really about taking food home. So in the beginning, I would make these veal roasts with, you know, stuffed with morels and all these fancy things, mm-hmm. and nobody wanted to buy them. And I thought, oh, people want roast chicken and roast carrots.
Mm-hmm.
So I very quickly shifted my focus of what I prepared at the store.
Bill in Newton, Massachusetts. Thank you for calling, Bill. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Ina. I feel very, very fortunate. My grandparents moved to East. I'm a New Yorker originally. My grandparents moved to East Hampton in the 40s. My grandfather was a fisherman.
Wow.
And so I was very fortunate to spend a lot of my summers out from New York in East Hampton. And I can't remember a better time than going into the Barefoot Contessa, immediately getting an espresso on the right-hand side and looking at a display of yogurt loaves. More than I've ever seen, and you were very nice to serve us, and walking down the aisle in the center of the store, all these prepared foods, Tom, were just amazing. So I feel a very close kinship to you, and I think we've driven by your house, perhaps, but, you know, having been out there for all that many years, my grandparents, unfortunately, are gone. But
Bill, do you remember Ina right there in the store at the Barefoot Contessa?
Of course. Yes.
I was always there.
She was always there, and it was, and actually my mom's still there, and the heartbreak was one winter or summer I came back, and there was I don't want to diminish it, but there was
a clothing store.
clothing store there, and I said, huh? Maybe I missed a spot. I was very fortunate growing up.
Oh, that's so, what great memories. You know, I always felt like Barefoot was a, looks like the heartbeat of the town. Everybody would say, oh, I'll meet you at Barefoot, and then we'll go wherever we're going.
Mm-hmm.
And people would come in and say, you know, they'd come to the register with these huge baskets of groceries and go, I just came in for a cup of coffee. But it was fun place to be. One of the things about the store that was important, and I think Bill probably feels that, is that it was the sight, the sound, the smell, everything about it when you walked in was really important to me. So you'd walk into the store, and there was a screen door that just, it's the sound of the country,
yes,
that would close behind you.
Yeah.
And as Bill said, there was an espresso machine right there, or coffee, or in the winter we'd have hot apple cider. So you would want to go over and help yourself to it. And then there was this huge long tables with a Viennese dessert table that had, you know, as we were talking about, mm-hmm. coconut cakes and mm-hmm. chocolate cupcakes and yogurt loaves and all kinds of delicious pastries that I hope you can't pass without ordering one. The music was great, and everybody just had a great time. So it was like a big party.
Talk about a remembered flavor. I mean, the screen door slamming in the summertime, wherever that is, that brings a lot back.
I don't think people realize how important that is, but it just makes them feel good when they walk in the store.
You write in the new cookbook, Cooking for Jeffrey, about the moment when you decided to let the store go and strike out a new direction, but you didn't know what that would be. Why'd you let it go, and how'd you make a turn?
Well, for about a year, I was trying to figure out what to do next. And a friend of mine, who happens to be a therapist, said to me, you know, type A people think they can figure out what they're doing next while they're doing something, and they can't.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh, that's interesting. Okay, so I'm just going to sell the store to two employees, which I did, the chef and the manager. Just financed it so they could do it, and built myself an office upstairs and tried to figure out what to do. And it was the absolutely hardest year I've ever had. But I'm really glad I did, because, you know, I went from making 1,000 baguettes one day to having nothing to do. And one day, in sheer desperation, maybe 9 months later, I thought, well, maybe I'll just write a cookbook, thinking at least I'll have something to do while I'm figuring out what I'm going to do next. And that's what I mean about the process. You just never know where it's going to lead you.
You say you didn't initially want to write a cookbook. It sounded like a lot of hours at the computer, not the sort of convivial social atmosphere of the Barefoot Contessa.
Exactly. It felt like a very solitary thing. But then as I started writing it, I realized that I love doing the photographs of the photographer and the food stylist and the prop stylist. And I love the process of writing it, and designing the book was important to me. So I really like the interaction with the people that I was working with. And I love testing recipes. So it turned out to be much different from what I expected.
Was TV on your mind at that point?
Oh, no. Not, certainly not.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings home financing into the 21st century with a completely online process that's fast, easy, and convenient. Using a phone or tablet, you can safely share bank statements and pay stubs without having to dig through piles of paperwork. It takes just a few minutes to get a custom mortgage solution on your terms, wherever and whenever you want. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Ina Garten. 10 cookbooks out there now. Her latest is Cooking for Jeffrey. You may know her from her Food Network show, The Barefoot Contessa. She has been in the biz for a long time. At 30, she left that job in Washington and went to the Hamptons, bought a little shop there, and has built an enormous career out of that humble beginning. Jeffrey, husband with her all the way, big taster and appreciator of Ina's cooking. And this cookbook, I guess you got to say right from the title, it's for him, Cooking for Jeffrey. You can join us this hour, and I know we've got people calling for you from all over the country. Tricia in Arvada, Colorado. Tricia, you're on the air with Ina Garten in New York.
Hello, Tom and Ina. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Mm-hmm. Hi, Tricia.
Hi. I work full-time. I've seen your cookbooks, never picked one up. I'm wondering, you make it sound so simple, which one of your 10 cookbooks should I start with?
You know, I find that as my cookbooks go on, I find them simpler and simpler. I get better and better at making them simple. I think Cooking for Jeffrey is a really good one. Like this skillet roasted chicken is just such a simple dish, and you end up with a wonderful dinner from it. I would say maybe the second one would be Back to Basics, which I deliberately made as simple as I could. But any of them really have great simple recipes that you can make.
Tricia, you say you haven't spent a lot of time in the kitchen. What's got you headed there now?
Kids are gone. Husband's gone. Or I should say he's an ex-husband now. So I'm on my own exploring my own pursuits.
Great. I hope your kitchen is full of wonderful aromas soon. You never know what that might pleasures that might bring.
Can I tell
yeah.
Tricia a story
yeah.
That I told in my last book? A woman I met, her mother, her father had passed away. She lived in a small town in the Cotswolds, I think, and she found herself really, the kids are out of the house, and she was on her own. And she started baking, cookies for when the postman showed up, and when the school kids were out of school, they would stop by, and she would bake granola bars for the birds.
Yeah.
It was just really charming. And she found that people would just stop by, and so she created a wonderful community for herself just by baking.
Tricia.
So I really encourage you to do it.
Do it. Enjoy it.
When you cook, people show up.
Colorado Tricia, get it going. You never know what will happen. Caroline in Nashville, Tennessee. Caroline, you're on the air with Ina.
Hi, Ina. Gosh, great to be chatting with you today.
So nice to talk to you.
I loved hearing how you kind of got your start with cooking when you were first a newlywed with Jeffrey. And I am getting married next week, and I have all of these aspirations of cooking for my husband and hosting lots of friends and family over to our apartment in New York. And I was just wondering if you had any tips for a new cook and a newlywed in this stage of life, and what I can do
Absolutely.
To get started entertaining.
You know, one of the things I think happens with cooking is you get overwhelmed with all the equipment and all the recipes. What I would do is choose maybe 5 recipes that you and your new husband love, and just make them over and over and over again. Really become an expert in them, and just get enough equipment so that you can do that. And if you don't have, you know, if a lot of equipment is very expensive. In New York, you can go to the Bowery, to one of the restaurant supply places, and get very inexpensive equipment and make a fabulous meal. So just try, don't try new things all the time. Try things and really perfect them first and then move on. Because if you can make a roast chicken, you can make a roast duck, you can make a roast capon, mm-hmm. and you can even make a roast turkey with the same process.
Keep it simple, make it good. Caroline, best wishes to you with your marriage there. I want to talk a little bit about your move to TV, and maybe one of our listeners writing online here will help us do that. J2P writes, I'm very fond of Ina Garten, one of the few TV cooks I can stand. Okay, there's a perspective.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, she seems like, this is you, a throwback to Julia Child, who, it is said, had a great impact on her, you. Natural and focused on the food and not on themselves as celebrities. How did you get into TV, and what about this assessment from our listener watching you?
Well, it's very flattering. Thank you. Because, of course, I admire Julia Child enormously because she did it with no precedence. Mm-hmm. I mean, she just did it on her own.
Number one.
I'd written, I think, two cookbooks, and Food Network came to me and said they wanted me to do a show. And I was like, no, I'm not a TV kind of person. I love writing cookbooks. I want to keep doing that. And they kept coming back again and again. And finally, I realized they thought I was negotiating with them. And I was like, no, I'm not negotiating. I just don't want to do this. I really don't think I'll be good at it because I'd really never done TV before. And in the meantime, I saw a show that I loved. It was a British show, and I asked them to get me a tape of it, and they got a tape, and unbeknownst to me, and actually it was Nigella Lawson's show, which Nigella is extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
But I said to them, I still don't want to do TV. Unbeknownst to me, they went to London, found the producer, and called me and said, she's coming to your house in 2 weeks. And I was like, whoa, wait a minute. So I thought, well, I'll just do 13 shows. You know, we'll do a couple of pilots, and then they'll realize that I'm absolutely right and that I can't do TV, and I'll never have to talk to them again. And happily, that was, I think, 14 years ago.
What's it like
and I'm
cooking?
I'm still with the same producer.
Very right there. What's it like cooking and preparing on television and explaining as you go versus just cooking? I mean, does it feel like theater all the time? Do you get lost in the music of the cooking, or is it all performance?
No, I see it actually as, once I got comfortable with that I was going to do TV, I realized that a lot of people can read a recipe and know what it is, how to chop, how to cut, how to slice, how to julienne. But some people really need somebody to show them what it is. And so I sort of see it as teaching my friend how to cook. It's a very personal thing. It doesn't feel like theater. It doesn't feel like performance at all. It feels like I'm just cooking and explaining to somebody how to do it.
Haga in Boston. Haga, thanks for calling. You're on the air with Ina Garten.
Hi, I'm so excited to be speaking with Ina today. She's one of my all-time favorite chefs to watch.
Thank you, Haga.
Excited to have this opportunity. So I'm Egyptian-American, and I grew up, I'm an immigrant, so we didn't have American food on our table growing up. Mm-hmm. So I really just want to thank you for so many amazing and easy broken-down recipes that helped me learn American.
Wonderful.
And some of it is continental, and some of it is French. So many cuisines that I've been able to learn from you, especially as a newlywed when I had more time to devote to some of the recipes, and some of them now are part of our, for example, Thanksgiving traditions. We always make the pumpkin butternut squash soup every single year. So those are just some of my great memories associated with you.
Wonderful.
And my
thank
question
you, Haga.
To you is you have so many cute tidbits and stories interwoven throughout your books, and it sounds like you have a pretty interesting life story. Have you ever thought about writing an autobiography?
Well, I kind of thought that this is a little bit of that. I like to a cookbook to have a story and not to just be a bunch of recipes all bound together. And so in a way, I think this is the beginning of that. But I think my life has been wonderful. I don't think it's so intriguing. but I think it was really nice to be able to share some stories about my life with Jeffrey in this book.
There are a bunch of good bits in here, Haga. If you're looking for that, you'll learn a fair amount interwoven with the recipes in cooking for Jeffrey. I appreciate your call from Boston. Let's go to Lake Orion.
Thanks, Haga.
Yeah, thanks, Haga. Lynn in Lake Orion, Michigan. Lynn, you're on the air with Ina Garten.
Well, hi, Tom. Hi,
hi.
Ina.
Hi.
Big fan
hi, Lynn.
Of both of yours. Hi, Ina. I tell you, I feel like you're a friend. I have been religiously watching your show, and I feel like my confidence as a cook has really skyrocketed once I found you and your books and your simple and easy steps in preparation. I love your style, your decorating, our mutual love of orange tulips. And
oh, yes.
Yes. Yep.
Can I get in on that? I love orange tulips also. So let me join that little club.
Okay.
They're beautiful.
Thanks.
In Chicago, you're welcome. I just think you're the best all around everything. And I have all of your cookbooks in my kitchen.
Oh, my goodness.
Very much. Yeah, and I very much use them. They're so beautiful, but I have got them dog-eared with Post-it notes and little notes everywhere. And I would love to know, Ina, and I think this would be a hard one for me, out of all the cookbooks, what would be your favorite recipe?
Of all my recipes, you know, there's one that I absolutely just is very, I don't know why, I just adore it, is the French apple tart in, I think it's it's on the cover of Back to Basics, I think. I love, to me, that's the quintessential recipe where it's just the thinnest pastry with sliced apples, sugar, butter into the oven, and it's just delicious. It's simple, it's easy to make, and it is, it has so much flavor. I think that's one of them.
French apple tart. That sounds pretty darn good. I've got another one of your desserts in front of me here.
Yeah, I was going to say that the panna cotta is not there either.
Maeve just made it for me. This is the vanilla rum panna cotta with salted caramel, and I've been holding it, waiting to bite it with great exercising tremendous restraint. I don't know how I possibly did it. Talk to us about how you put together a panna cotta, a good panna cotta, this one.
Panna cotta, I think a lot of people are afraid of panna cotta. I don't know why. It's kind of like vinaigrette. It's so easy to do. You mix up cream and milk, and in this case, I used good vanilla and rum and some gelatin to thicken it, and you pour it into little glasses, however you want to do it, or you can unmold it, but it's so much easier to put it in a little glass. Put it in the refrigerator overnight, and then when you're ready to serve it, heat up a little bit of salt, caramel sauce with a little rum, pour it on top, and a little salt. So you get the crunch of the salt, the sweet caramel that's warm, and the cold panna cotta. It's just amazing.
What makes the panna cotta? Yeah, I just want you to keep talking. What makes the panna cotta set up? What makes it stand up? Is that the gelatin?
A little bit of gelatin, just a little bit, just enough so that it just gels. But you don't want it to be like Jell-O, glutinous.
Oh no!
You just want it to just barely come together.
This is unbelievable. And that sort of effervescence of the rum in here and salted caramel. I mean, caramel is great enough on its own, but when you put salt on it, it just makes people crazy. Why is it? What's going on there?
Well, I think salt is important for everything, frankly.
Yeah.
I think people got crazy about no salt, which it turns out not to be true, that that we all need salt in our diet. And there's something, it just, and I think people think of salt for savory things, but in fact, they're really important for sweet things. You know, pound cake needs salt. And certainly the caramel, that really intense sweetness of the caramel and the salt are really good balance for each other. And also the textures. One is kind of creamy and one's crunchy, which is really important.
New cookbook is Cooking for Jeffrey, and Anna writes to us on Twitter, "What's your favorite thing about cooking for Jeffrey, for him in particular?"
I think it's just the smile on his face. He just adores when I cook for him. And I think it's as much the food that I'm making as it is the act of doing it. One time I made him a cup of tea, and he said, "This is the best tea I've ever had." And I was like, "Jeffrey, it's hot water in a tea bag." But I put a little bit of raspberry jam in it, so it was just different. It had a little more flavor. Mm. And I think just it's that nurturing kind of thing that makes people feel good.
And where did you come up with it? I was at a sauna in Lower Manhattan, a Russian sauna, had tea there. They put cherry jam or jelly in it.
That's it. It's Russian. That's exactly what it is.
It was fantastic, especially after a big sweat. Patricia in Peoria, Illinois. Patricia, you're on with Ina Garten.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Ina.
Hi, Patricia.
I have two questions for you. I would like to know what kind of music you play at dinner parties, and I would like some insight into your recipe development. You mentioned once that you don't even test recipes on Jeffrey. So I'd like to know who you do test them on and what's involved in your recipe development.
Well, the question, those are good questions. The question about party music is I always start with something very upbeat, like the Beach Boys or the Beatles or something for Taylor Swift or something fun. So when the first person walks in the door, they know they've come to a party.
Mm-hmm.
And then later in the evening, for dinner, we'll have like old-fashioned things like Tony Bennett and Frank Sinatra, much more sort of soothing. And then just as I'm serving dessert, I like to have a little more upbeat music when people are kind of like a little too sated and they're falling asleep. You want them to sort of perk up. So I really do work very hard on the music to make sure it's appropriate. And my recipe testing process actually is very deliberate and I do it a lot. I start out with an idea of a recipe, and I just start cooking. And sometimes I'll get it on the third shot, and I remember one coffee cake that I literally made 25 times until I got the flavor, the texture, exactly what I was looking for. And I work with my assistant, Barbara, who's wonderful, good home cook, and I hand her the recipe, and I say, make it, and I watch her make it. And I want to see if she has any trouble with the written word. So all she has is the written, you know, a piece of typewriter paper. And then I make it for Jeffrey, and I make it for friends. And I really test it out on a lot of people before it actually makes it into a book.
You got to keep track every time of how you've done it as you do it a little bit differently each time.
I'm very scientific.
Very scientific. Science, it's lab work. One for the moms here before we go. We've got a couple of moms writing in who, you know, how does a mom continue her creativity when all the little ones want is chicken fingers? Help! And then another who says, I'm tired of my usual fall and winter casserole kind of dishes. Can you suggest something the kids will love, but that's a bit different? They love my tetrazzini from scratch. No canned cream of soup. What's a good warm fall winter dish? Something to go on, Ina?
Well, there's some good ones in here, actually. There's rigatoni with sausage that I think kids would like. And there's a pasta with cauliflower, baked pasta. So it's all in one dish, and you just put it in the oven. You can make it in the morning, refrigerate it, and then just throw it in the oven before dinner.
Ann says, what about going vegan? You ever going to do it?
No. I think, you know, I'm always conscious of people that are coming for dinner, and I make sure there's enough for everybody to eat. But if, you know, somebody who's vegan comes for Thanksgiving, I'm going to make a roast turkey, and then I'm going to make enough vegetables so they can have what they want for dinner. But I'm not somebody who does vegan.
not Ina's way, but there's a lot of way that's right here. Well, I'm now looking out on a table that has this wonderful challah, that has your skillet roasted lemon chicken, that has this vanilla rum panna cotta with salted caramel.
I think it's all over you now?
it will be soon. It'll be all over me soon. It's been really delightful talking with you, Ina, and hearing from your fans around the country. Thanks so much for taking the time to be with us. Really wonderful.
Thank you, Tom. Love talking to you. Thank you.
Really a pleasure. Ina Garten, her new cookbook is Cooking for Jeffrey, a Barefoot Contessa Cookbook. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook NPR. You can be the first to get tomorrow's topics and guests by going to our Facebook page, On Point Radio. Hit that like button. You'll get alerts coming up on upcoming shows right there in your news feed. On Point is produced by Nick Anderson, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Maeve Pages, Sarah Platt, Tanya Rally, and James Ross, with help from Anita Taventry, Halima Gikandi, and Weiwa Lee. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.